America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Well, a lot of the news today that we will be getting to as we go through the program. The House of Representatives proposing to, what would the right word be? Restrengthen, reauthorize, whatever, tighten up the FISA laws. The New York Times reporting that they're going to capitulate to the Bush administration. Doesn't look to me like that's what's going on. And we will be getting into that. Rush Limbaugh beating up a 12-year-old on the air. It's tragic, really. And many other interesting things in the news today. We'll be talking in our second hour about, do parents have the right to make elective surgery choices for severely disabled kids? Or for that matter, should judges have the right to force kids to take drugs? And in our third hour, is America really ready to return to rational trade policies? David Sirota is going to drop by. We're going to have an interesting conversation. Right now, Dr. Michael Brown is with us. He is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of the FIRE, F-I-R-E, School of Ministry in Concord, North Carolina, coalitionofconscience.org, the website. Dr. Brown, welcome to the program. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, welcome to the program. You can
Thanks.
Hear me.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you very much. Question. You posed the question on your website, coalitionofconscience.org, and have written at some length about whether it's possible to be Christian and to be gay. And I'm wondering if it's possible under those terms to be Christian and to play football.
Well, you know, playing football in itself is not a moral issue that's dividing the country and dividing churches and raising all kinds of relevant questions.
But you could make it one.
I appreciate you coming at it from that angle, but
you could make it one, because right in Leviticus, in the same place where it says you can't have gay sex, it also says you can't touch the carcass of a pig.
Well, actually, that's not in the same place. I mean, you're a careful student of the Constitution, and, you know, you have to read things in context, et cetera. And let me say first, we had a public forum, and we invited homosexual clergy to a church service to say, how can it hurt to talk about the issues in public? And the first message we wanted to send out to the homosexual community is, we don't hate you. We may have differences over some of these issues and look at scriptures different ways, but the first thing we wanted to say, we don't hate you. If we can sit down and talk, we can put arms around each other and have an honest dialogue without it being called hate speech. So that's the first thing. But in point of fact, really, I believe the scriptures do give a clear answer for those that follow the scriptures and believe that the Bible has authority. There is a clear answer. And the clear answer is we've all fallen short. We all have issues. We all have needs. And according to the Bible, Jesus died for all of us alike, homosexual and heterosexual. But that doesn't mean that I can say I'm a follower of Jesus and yet I'm
yeah,
having adulterous
Dr. affair. Brown, where in the New Testament does Jesus condemn homosexuality?
Well, there are three places at least where you would find Jesus addressing it. First in Matthew 5, verses 17 to 20. He makes clear that he didn't come to abolish what was written in Moses or the prophets, but rather to bring it to its full meaning.
Okay, so in the Sermon on the Mount, you're saying that Jesus says that we shouldn't be playing football and we shouldn't be eating shellfish.
No, because those were things that were specifically given to Israel to keep them separate from the nations.
This is all Leviticus. Leviticus 11, the swine, their carcass ye shall not touch, Leviticus 11, 8.
Right.
Leviticus chapter 19, you know, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap the edge all the way to the edge. And if you can't sow two different kinds of seed, you can't wear a garment woven of two different kinds of thread. These laws are not ever specifically restated by Jesus. And in fact, the modern-day Christianity says, no, sorry, that was the Old Testament. I mean, there are people, the Hasidic community, that actually keeps this. In Leviticus, it says, don't cut the hair from your temples.
Right.
And so, you know,
answer your question, though, back to Leviticus 18, where the prohibition against homosexuality occurs, that's a universal prohibition. That's for all people. If you read the context, that's not like the laws that were just given to Israel to keep them separate from the nations, and we could debate whether they still apply to Jews.
Leviticus chapter 18 opens.
Begins by saying that
the Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and tell them, I, the Lord, am your God.
Right. Keep going.
It says
that God judged the Canaanites and the Egyptians for practicing incest, bestiality, homosexuality.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, so now let's go to Leviticus 19, chapter 19, where it says that it is a crime to wear two different a piece of clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric or to eat shellfish. It starts out, the Lord said to Moses, speak to the whole Israelite community and tell them, be holy, for I, the Lord, their God, am a holy. And revere your father, etc. Every chapter of Leviticus basically starts out in Leviticus 11, where he talks about not touching a pig. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and Aaron, saying unto them, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, these are the beasts
right,
which
right.
you shall
eat. If you look at the beginning and the end of chapter 18, it says specifically that these things are universal abominations. I mean, you're not arguing that incest is okay or that bestiality is okay. The things that are forbidden in Leviticus 18, we universally agree are wrong. Incest, bestiality, the only question is homosexual practice. And listen, it's not the
every same. Single chapter of Leviticus says these things for all
the
of these laws.
Of Leviticus 18 and 19, it's different than every other chapter in Leviticus, and it says that these were universal abominations because of which God actually judged the Canaanites.
Okay, so Leviticus 18, which also on this in 22nd chapter says, man shall not lay with a man as a woman. It's an abomination. And you're saying that that chapter is an absolute, this is the law, this is the way it should be. In that chapter, in the 19th verse, it also says, you shall not approach a woman to have intercourse with her while she's unclean from menstruation. Shall we start condemning people for sleeping in the same bed with their wives when they're having their periods?
No, but I don't believe that it's a good thing for a man to have sexual relations with his wife during her period. You may argue.
So now we're changing the rules of Leviticus from being rules that have to do with abominations and crimes to being whether they're good things or not?
No, abomination is something that's detestable, something that's wrong, something that's unclean, something that's impure.
Right, and Leviticus says eating shellfish is an abomination, specifically. It uses that word.
For the Jewish people, it was. Right. It was given that, like, for example, Deuteronomy 14 says this is detestable to you, for you. But God is not judging the whole world whether they eat shrimp or not. And Jesus himself came and said the things that you eat don't defile you. But you asked where he deals with the homosexual issue. Matthew 19, he specifically says that God's order from the beginning is that God made male and female, and the two become one flesh. That was the created order, and that they are to join together, to multiply. So it's not
that's not a condemnation of homosexuality.
No, it's saying that God's created order is male, female.
In fact, Jesus went out of his way not to condemn. He said, you know, let the first among you who is perfect throw the first stone.
Well, let me ask you this. Just where did Jesus specifically address child abuse? Where did Jesus specifically address pedophilia? Where did Jesus specifically address bestiality? He doesn't address any of those things specifically, and yet you're not advocating those things based on the where did Jesus address it.
There are a thousand areas of rational morality that societies have historically held, and obviously some of the things you mentioned. But if you're going to pick out of Leviticus one particular thing and say, okay, this is it, this is the one, you have to take the rest of Leviticus.
Well, I have to take all of Leviticus.
If you're playing football, you are as much of a sinner as somebody who's gay, according to Leviticus.
I'd encourage you to think through the implications of Leviticus 18 being universal abominations, but it doesn't just stand alone. I mean, Paul addresses it.
Then we need to be condemning men who are sleeping with their women, with their wives when they're having their periods.
Paul does not address that issue specifically. Paul specifically addresses homosexuality in several passages, and there are many.
Paul was not Jesus.
That accept it. Many gay scholars, you can go to the Gay and Lesbian Online Encyclopedia or the New Encyclopedia of Homosexuality and Religion, and they say, yeah, Paul did speak against homosexual practice. It's true. And again, listen,
if somebody is gay and they want to be a Christian, what, in your opinion, must they do?
I know it's challenging, and I don't want to seem insensitive. They can come to God exactly as they are, but they cannot ask him to sanction a same-sex relationship. They have to be celibate until God gives them help if he changes their orientation.
So their only choice is to become a Catholic priest, essentially.
And then start abusing boys. No, but listen, I mean, the fact is there are many heterosexuals that live celibate lives for many years. There are people who are married, and there's an injury to the partner, and because of that, they have to remain sexually celibate. I'm not saying it's easy. I don't mean that I don't mean it in a trite way, and I know that there are gay people listening that'll say, I love Jesus as much as
and
you
you're
love
not,
Jesus.
And you're not willing to call on Christians to avoid handling pig skins or to stop eating shellfish, even though these are abominations
no,
in
those,
Leviticus.
No, those were specific laws given to the Jewish people to keep.
You're not willing to call on Christians to avoid their Christian men to avoid their wives when they're menstruating.
I think it's a good practice for Christian men to not have sex with their wives while menstruating. I think it's a good position.
So why not elevate that to the level of this? I mean, that's far more frequent in the United States than gay sex.
Well, listen, it's far more frequent that we've got pornography, heterosexual pornography. It's far more frequent.
That's not mentioned in Leviticus.
Unjustifiable divorce. I deal with all these issues.
That's
point of fact, I point a finger at the church, the hypocrisy among the leaders, the scandals that we have, be it a Jimmy Swaggart scandal, be it a Ted Haggard scandal. Man, we need help. But I'm saying, let's just...
Well, we all need help. We all need help. Dr. Michael Brown, coalitionofconscience.org. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Larry Craig.
Hey there, what you doing out there? Here in this men's room, the stall could be 10 rooms for romance. I can hear somebody going. I can hear the dryer blowing. You've got a flight soon, but I think I might soon have no pants. Oh, my sweet meat, tap three times on the pipe if you want me. Twice on the pipe if you brought me a leash. Oh, my darling, means you'll meet me in the jetway. Come on, knock on the door if you're not the police. This, of course, does not mean I'm gay. Sex isn't gay if it's done by two straight guys together.
Ah, yes, Larry Craig.
Idaho man.
He's such an icon. Today's Pearls Before Swine cartoon in the paper about having a wide stance in the men's room. It's got to be tough. It's got to be tough for hypocrites, shall we say. Speaking of hypocrisy and Matthew 5, which Dr. Brown brought up, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. It's the first chapter of the Sermon on the Mount. And this is such a classic example that Jesus was the original liberal. I mean, if you want to put this in a political context, in Matthew 5, 9, he says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." In Matthew 5, 39, he says, "Resist not evil. If somebody hits you on the right cheek, turn to him the left also." In Matthew 5, 44, he says, "Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you." In Matthew 21, he talks about the death penalty. He says, "Thou shalt not kill." Crime and punishment. Jesus, a screaming liberal here. Matthew 7. The tail end of the Sermon on the Mount. If anyone, actually, it's, I guess it's, no, it's, yeah, this is not from, in any case, he says, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to cast a stone. Do not judge, lest you be judged." Oh, I'm sorry, that was John 8, 7. Yeah, Matthew 7, the tail end of the Sermon on the Mount. "Do not judge, lest you be judged. For the same way you judge others, you will be judged." Community, the sense of community. Love your neighbors yourself. And I just, oh, yes, we love gays, but you can't be gay. I am firmly of the opinion that if people are going to pick and choose out of the Old Testament the laws that they want to impose on the rest of us and that they think should be enforced, whether they be in the churches or in the state, that they need to take the whole thing or nothing at all. At least the Hasidim are consistent. The Jewish sect that only wears clothing made of a single fabric and doesn't cut the hair from their temples or their beards and doesn't eat shellfish and is absolutely kosher, you know, is absolutely compliant with all those laws in Leviticus. Tim in New York City. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was listening to, it was Dr. Brown, I think he was speaking with.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just a comment in that the proponents of relying upon the Bible, it just really makes me step back. And my comment is that the Bible was written by men who were mortal. And the way he speaks and many others who speak of the Bible, as if there's no question whatsoever, there's this like heavenly quill that came down and it was God's hand who wrote this himself.
Well, the belief is that it was inspired by God. But, I think that there are many people who consider themselves religious and who consider themselves Christian who question that. Peter Funk has written some, and Elaine Pagel's written extensively on that.
Well, to quote it, to say, okay, homosexuality, just as he brought up the subject matter, is, you know, an abomination. It's written, no questions asked, that's how we live. It's like, well, wasn't that written by men, the Bible itself, and could that be also the interjection of their own opinions on life?
Sure, and the same thing with shellfish. I mean,
exactly.
It's an abomination.
Is to live 2,000 years later on something that some mortal wrote because it was his idea of what things were right.
Here's the real kicker. In the Sermon on the Mount, he's promoting Christianity, talking about what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in the 6th chapter of Matthew. Jesus explicitly said, don't ever pray in public. If you pray in public, it doesn't count. And you know, it's like you walk into a church and everybody's praying in public. This is something that was banned by Jesus. We never discussed homosexuality.
There's so many conflicting points. You can go on and on. My point is, this is how I feel about it, is that if you're rational and you're an individual and you rely upon your own sanity, that, and with others and community as well, you come up with the healthiest way of living. I think this is why we have problems in the environment, for example. We've screwed the nature. We just say, like, you know, let's just do whatever we want with oil, for example, and trash the earth. So we have a problem that's going to be huge in the near future. We don't live in the present. We live in this past of rules that don't apply any longer.
Well, to some extent, it comes out of a worldview that says that we are uniquely different from everything else in nature, and we have a unique connection, therefore, to the creator of all of nature, and that it's a different connection than all the other living things.
Yeah, well, that's proven to be false, right?
I know. That's my point. And it's a very, very dysfunctional belief system
that is
just rife through our culture. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 866-303-2270. FISA capitulations coming up. We'll share a little of that with you. We'll also continue taking your calls on this topic if you'd like. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
You tell him, Willie.
Say, what do you think all them saddles and boots was about? And there's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels for his brother. And inside every cowboy there's a lady that'd like to slip out.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Willie, now I could listen to Willie Nelson all day long. I just play nothing else. Fine with me. Welcome back to our program. Well, he's up to it again.
Condescending tribes making money selling wine. You might say everybody hates my guts.
Time for our Rush Alert.
I'm a bigot. I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do. And I've told you this. They always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
Yeah, and this is the month he goes off probation, too.
I'm a Nazi. He's a Nazi.
So is he going off his rails?
I don't care about the middle class. I'm a fat conservative butthead with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative butthead. Hey.
Well, our Rush Alert for the day. Limbaugh now is out there trashing the 12-year-old kid who 2 weeks ago did the Democratic rebuttal, talking about how he had been in a serious car accident. His family has never earned more than $45,000 a year. He has a scholarship to a nice school, His family bought their house well over a decade ago for about $50,000. But the right-wing blogosphere is out there going, oh, these guys live in a $400,000 house. And he's going to a school where it's $45,000 a year tuition. Well, he has a scholarship to that school. And no, the family is not wealthy. He is exactly what he presented himself as, a 12-year-old who would be dead if it wasn't for the S-CHIP program, or who certainly wouldn't be in as good a shape as he is because he had a very, very severe injury that and it didn't wipe out his family financially because of the S-CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program. But Limbaugh, nah.
So the bottom line for me is they can't rely on truth to make their case for their cause. They have to lie. Be it about me, be it about their own voters, such as the Frosts, be it about President Bush, they must lie.
Yeah. So this 12-year-old kid, he's a liar, and Michelle Malkin's out stalking his house, and Limbaugh's out trashing him on the radio. Have these guys no shame.
In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the copper, the cop of Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob.
So, anyhow, 37 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Rob in Manhattan, I'm listening to WWRL. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi, Tom. How are you? Tom,
I'm fine.
Oh, by the way, I'm a very long-time listener of Air America. I listen to about 5 or 6 hours of Air America a day. As a matter of fact, I'm an addict. I just want to mention, Tom, that I am a gay man, and unfortunately I had to listen to that despicable brainwashed Bible bigot. But, you know, can you hear me? I'm sorry.
I can, just fine.
Okay, I want to say something. First of all, in Leviticus, it doesn't just say it's an abomination. It says thou shalt be killed after abomination. And it goes on and on about that. I just want to mention that a gay man was just murdered recently in Texas. And the man that murdered him said, you know, he followed him to a gay bar and stabbed him in the head and then burnt his body or something. Mm-hmm. And they asked him why he did it, and he said he was doing God's work.
Right. This is a form of hate speech. And Michael Brown starting out his comments. Well, actually, I don't even want to talk about him because he's not here to defend himself. But any time these guys, they start out by saying, I don't really hate these people. We love them. We're just, I'm sorry. You can't pick and choose. And particularly when we're talking about a class of people and vilifying them and you're absolutely right, Rob. You're absolutely right. And that's why I've tried to put it in this larger context of, you know, okay, in the exact same part of the Bible, in Leviticus, well, in the exact same chapter of Leviticus, it says that a married man can't sleep in the same bed with his wife if she's menstruating.
And
I don't hear any campaigns about that.
And Tom, as I remember, it also says that if your child disobeys you, you can kill him.
Yeah, you must kill him.
You must kill him.
Yes, so, that's in Leviticus either 17 or 18. Yes, absolutely right, Robin.
You know what you should do, really, honestly? Read Mel White's, you know, Religion Gone Bad. You know, he was the man that was the ghostwriter for Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. And then, you know, he realized he was a, you know, gay man and he came out of the closet. Because really what they're after, I don't really care, Tom, if they think you can't be Christian and gay at the same time. But what they want to do is they want to get at our Constitution and change it.
Yeah. What they want to do is they want to get at our culture and change it, and they want to do it in a way that puts them in charge. This ultimately, Rob, is about power. That's really what this is about.
Right. And our Constitution didn't ever mention the word God or the scriptures in it, but they want to put it in it now, and they want to make sure. If it's a separation of church and state, they don't want us in their churches or their synagogues or whatever. That's their prerogative. But they want to take it to our government, and they want to make sure that they deprive gay people of every privilege because of their misogynistic homophobia, you know.
Yeah,
that's
well
all
said, Rob.
Say.
Yep, thank all you right. very much. Very well said. And let's keep in mind the genesis of all this. People like Jerry Falwell.
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. John in Walnut Creek, California, listening on KGRN. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. I'm just amazed that the Christian church is organized around a man that preached against organized religion. If Jesus was intolerant of anything, it was organized religion.
Yeah, you're right. Going into the temple and turning over the tables and preaching against the Pharisees. Of all the things, all of the very few things, frankly, that he opposed, because most of his teachings were positive. This is what you should do. Good point.
Yeah. It's like the Indian Army having special forces unit and call it the Gandhi unit or something, you know?
Yeah. Well said, John. Thank you very much. Joe in Corvallis, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Good morning. Yeah, you know, to understand the Bible, the New Testament, particularly, one needs to look back at the Jewish nation at the time and to realize that they were fighting each other. They were killing each other, maybe like the Shiites and the Sunnis are doing now, or maybe even worse. Mm. And yeah. The Pharisees were the ones in the walled cities who were very wealthy, who were actually dealing with the Romans in some fashion. And so when Jesus in Matthew 23 talks about the Pharisees, you have to think that Jesus is really a Jew. And he's talking about a leader of the Jew that is, in fact, causing huge problems to his people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the historical context is extremely important to understand what is actually going on. PBS did a series called their Empire series called Kingdom of David, the Saga of the Israelites. And the last chapter or two chapters of that really go into the times. They don't talk about Jesus hardly at all, but they do talk about the Jewish problems and the context in which Jesus lived.
Right, yeah, and one of the reasons that the Jews were so aggressively looking for a Messiah because of the oppression of the Romans. Good point, Joe. Thank you very much. Another Joe, and this one in Wesley Chapel, Florida. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. Afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would disagree with you about homosexuality being compatible with Christian faith because I agree with Dr. Brown. And your caller a few minutes ago was wrong. That doesn't make him a bigot because love is not just a spoken word. Love is an action verb. It's something you have to do. And when you said that Jesus said don't pray in public, that was wrong. You took it out of context. He told the people, don't be hypocrite like the Pharisees and draw attention to yourself.
No, go back and read Matthew. He said, don't pray in public like the hypocrites.
That's right, like the hypocrites. That doesn't mean you can't pray in public. But as far as homosexuality and Christianity...
Okay, you may have a point there.
If you believe that homosexuality is not a deviant, perverse sexual behavior, then you can accept that and say that it is
and still be a Christian.
If
and still be a Christian. My point is, Joe, you're saying that this is not hate speech. I'm saying that you're talking about an entire class of people and people who are, by and large, born this way. This is the way they are. This is who they are. And it is the exact same argument that the Mormon Church used for years and years when they said that the mark of Cain was blackness of skin. It is the same argument that was made by the Calvinists 200 years ago. It is a class of people.
Race.
You are talking about a class of people. And when you say that a class of people are condemned by God, you are setting them up for death and destruction by people who think that God is.
I'm not saying they're condemned any more than you're condemned or I'm condemned because we are sinners, too. What I'm saying
we're splitting hairs here, Joe.
No, we're not splitting hairs. We're not splitting hairs at all. It goes back to what your caller said that you agreed with, that if I disagree with you, that's hate speech and I'm a bigot. You're wrong, because love is in doing. And Jesus said many things, and you have to take them into context.
I'm not talking about agreeing or disagreeing with me, Joe. I'm talking about condemning a class of people for who they are.
Dr. Brown didn't condemn them. I don't condemn them. I say their behavior is not compatible with...
Well, you're condemning their behavior then, and I would say that because their behavior in part defines who they are...
Behavior, Tom.
You condemn
your own sins?
Yes, I do.
Good.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You know, one of my earliest mentors in the advertising business, back when I was in my 20s and learning advertising and marketing, working in an ad agency, was a fellow who was then in his 50s. He's now in a nursing home, and we had a telephone conversation a year or so ago when he had lost his ability to walk, and he made a comment about how he was surrounded by straight people. He was a gay guy, and just a wonderful man. And this today's New York Times article by Jane Gross, it opens, even now at 81, with her memory beginning to fade, Gloria Donadello recalls her painful brush with bigotry at an assisted living center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, sitting with those she considered friends. She said, people were laughing and making certain kinds of comments, and I told them, please don't do that because I'm gay. The result of her outspokenness, Ms. Donadello said, was swift and merciless. Everyone looked horrified, she said. No longer included in conversation or welcomed at meals, she plunged into depression. They go on to note elderly gay people like Ms. Donadello, living in nursing homes or assisted living centers or receiving home care, increasingly are reporting that they have been disrespected, shunned, or mistreated in ways that range from hurtful to deadly, even leading some to commit suicide. What happened to the notion that we're all just people here? Daniel in Los Angeles. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Tom. First-time caller. And I share your last name, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
You know, what I was thinking about is I'm a psychiatric nurse, and I deal with people that have delusional thought structures. And it always comes to mind when I hear someone arguing with Christians about these types of issues, you know. You know, we always say with somebody who's delusional, you know, the last thing you want to do is argue with them. I mean, they have beliefs that are based upon structures of fixed false beliefs that just can't be challenged. They won't allow themselves to be challenged. They'll always have an answer for everything. You know, I think what's more important, instead of arguing with people on the point of religion, is arguing with them on the point of, fairness in government. And, you know, in other words, if you want your religion to, if you want to adhere to your religious doctrine, then go ahead. But don't discriminate against other people. You know what I mean?
No, I agree with you, Daniel. And at the same time, if you're going to proclaim that your religious doctrine is the basis for what could become law or certainly would become social standards, then at least be consistent in your application of your religious doctrine. If you're going to quote Leviticus to me, then quote all of Leviticus to me. You know, don't selectively quote it.
That's why I think it's dangerous, because, you know, then you'll get into this endless argument with them, and, you know, they're basically basing their lives on a fairy tale. And, you know, my pastor and my magic book said this, so therefore, I mean, you can't argue with that, you know.
I did, but I get your point. Your point is well made. Daniel, thank you very much. James in Oakland, California. Hey, James.
Hi, Tom. I enjoy your show. I just want to make a comment. There's nowhere in the New Testament, if you look at the Bible and the titles in the literal sense, the Old Testament, New Testament, we're not dealing with the Old Testament in this time and period. We're in the New Testament period.
And at least that's what Christians believe.
Well, I mean, that was back.
There are Hasidic Jews who others who would not subscribe to that.
Well, if you look at the historical sense, they didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah, the Jews back
that's my point.
Ones that handed him over to the Romans. So what we're saying, they didn't believe he was a Messiah, so that's what happened. The scribes and the Pharisees, the scribes are the people that, they're supposed to translate the word, and then the scribes are the ones that actually write it down, interpret it.
Yeah, but what's your point, James?
So what I want to say is there's nothing in the Bible that says against homosexuality. Matter of fact, it says it'll be more tolerable in Sodom and Gomorrah than it'll be for these hypocrites. And you know who we're talking about, the hypocrites, the publicans and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
It
says that. It says it'll be more tolerable in Sodom and Gomorrah than it'll be for these hypocrites. And that says that also. Now, another thing they try to justify is that, well, in Timothy 2, that lovers will become, men will become lovers of themselves. That means, in a sense, they'll love themselves more than God. So there's nothing in the New Testament that forbids anything as far as homosexuality. Yeah, we have to have moral norms and so forth, but...
Yeah, there's nothing I can find there either. James, your point is well made. I think that it is entirely possible and just a fine thing to be Christian and gay and to play football and to handle pink skins. Ron in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ron.
How you doing, Tom? I'd like to first thank you for allowing me to speak in this forum here.
You're welcome.
And, yeah, it was pretty funny. The other day I was driving, I saw someone that said or had a bumper sticker on the back of their car that said, Rush is right, with an American flag fight. I just started laughing. I couldn't believe I saw it. In fact, that made me think I'm going to get a bumper sticker myself that says, I am straight, but I love gay people. Maybe that'll throw some people for a twist there.
Or Rush is right.
Yeah, unbelievable. And I don't want to really reiterate here too much here, but, I mean, I think homosexuality is a sin, but, again, all sins, we're all sinners, and if I'm correct, in the Old Testament, God spoke that all sins are equal, or all sins are equal in the eyes of God, so, I mean, murder is the same.
No, actually, you're wrong, Ron. There are categories of sins. There are little ones and big ones, and then there's abominations and all that kind of thing, and then, you know, in Christianity, there's the context of, you know, all have fallen short, you know, but I don't want to turn this into a discussion of theology. I appreciate your call, though. Mark in Santa Fe, we have just a few seconds, Mark, before we got to wrap up this hour.
All right, I guess I'm not going to be able to make my whole point, but in my own mind, I figure that they didn't eat pork at the writing of the Old Testament because they were in the desert, and if they got trichinosis, it would kill them.
And shellfish are scavengers. And there's also an injunction against
I'm not defending any of this. I'm just saying, in homosexuality, they were building a nation. But obviously,
that's right. They needed as many young men as possible for the army, and the same thing with you know. So you can argue that sociologically, at that point in time and place, a lot of these injunctions made sense. They don't anymore. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. In this hour, I'd like to get into some of the issues of the power of government and how far it should extend and what we should be. At what point do we limit government and at what point do we empower families? And there's really a couple of frames for this. One has to do with the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that is being reviewed and renewed. And another has to do with a case that's happening in England right now, which echoes one that happened here in the United States about a year ago, where a family with a severely disabled daughter, she's 15 years old, she has cerebral palsy, she cannot speak, and they want to give her a hysterectomy. They want the local hospital to perform a hysterectomy on her so that she won't have menstrual periods because they don't want her to have the pain and emotional up and downs and you know, the quality of life problems that are associated with menstruation. And the question is, should that be legal? Should that be allowed? Similarly, oddly enough, Phyllis Schlafly, blogging or writing over at her forum about whether it's constitutional for a judge, as happened in family court in Albany, New York, to force a 7-year-old kid to take Ritalin for ADHD, to force it, to say that his parents can go to jail or could lose custody. So, you know, where do we draw these lines? And with regard to the wiretapping powers, one of the things that I find very interesting about this FISA issue, the bill has just been submitted by the Democrats in the House of Representatives. You'll recall that before the congressional session ended, there was apparently some kind of deal. Nobody knows the details. My guess is that Bush said to Reid and Pelosi, I will not make any recess appointments while you guys take vacation in August if you will give me 6 months of extending the FISA law. And that he was, you know, that they got suckered into this thing. Because, A, I don't think he had any intention of making recess appointments, and, B, he figured give it 6 months, and once it's law, it's going to be damn hard to get rid of it, just like the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act was supposed to expire after 4 years. It's still with us. In fact, it's getting worse. So the New York Times today reporting the article by Eric Lichtblau and Carl Hulse. And Eric Lichtblau is a really good national security reporter. He's done a lot of very, very good reporting over the years on these kinds of issues. And they're suggesting, now this is an article that was probably written yesterday before the bill came out. The bill just came out a couple of hours ago. They're suggesting that basically it looks like the Democrats in Congress are about to roll over and give Bush what he wants on FISA. In fact, here's a quote. Although they willing to oppose the White House in the Iraq war, the Democrats, remain nervous that they will be called soft on terrorism if they insist on strict curbs on gathering intelligence. Well, a lot of us who, you know, read that this morning in the paper before the bill came out said, oh, no, here we go again. The Democrats are going to cave in. And then the bill came out. And Glenn Greenwald, writing about it over at Salon.com, there's a good summary of it over at thinkprogress.org, Jane at firedoglake.com, blogging about it. When you read the actual bill, it looks like the Progressive Caucus actually got a lot of what they want. I mean, there's this piece of legislation, in fact, in all probability, will be vetoed by the White House because it requires Bush to inform Congress of the identities of all the people. Well, this is from the legislation itself. It will compel the administration, quote, to reveal to Congress the details of all electronic surveillance conducted without court orders since September 11, 2001, including the so-called terrorist surveillance program, end quote. Now, keeping in mind that there was a guy working out of Orrin Hatch's office, Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah, the Republican, who had hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer in the first couple of years of the Bush administration, for over a year was reading Ted Kennedy's email every day and sharing the contents of it with the Republican caucus so that when federal judge issues, you know, appointments were coming before the Senate to be ratified, the Democrats would, you know, engage in a strategy session and email, and the Republicans were always way ahead of them. And the Democrats were like, what's the deal? We can't figure this out. They finally found out that this guy had hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer, among others, actually. Several people's computers. Several Democrats. So, and you know, there's never been a serious investigation of this. The guy quit his job in Orrin Hatch's office and has gone on to bigger and better things. Orrin Hatch apologized, and that seemed to be the end of it. But I guarantee you, if Al Gore was president right now, and he was asserting that he had the right to wiretap anybody he wanted without any judge reviewing it or without Congress reviewing it, basically without anybody knowing about it, the Republicans would be out there screaming, Al Gore wants to read my email. He wants to know about the politics. This is all about politics, my friends. He wants to. And that would have been the rant. Because that's what the Republicans do. That's what Nixon did. It was called the Watergate scandal. And as I said, that's what happened, you know, with this guy working out of Orrin Hatch's office a couple of years ago. And frankly, I'm perfectly willing to believe that a large number of the people that Bush has been wiretapping have been Democrats rather than terrorists. And that's why I think that he would veto this. So anyhow, it turns out that this piece of legislation actually looks like it's pretty solid. There's no amnesty, no immunity for the telecommunications companies. AT&T doesn't get a free pass for participating with the Bush administration in illegal intelligence gathering, for example. Administration officials don't get a free pass. It requires that the executive branch create a database and record the identity of all Americans who are listened in on. And that this be available to Congress. Now, the question, and Glenn Greenwald brings this up, you know, the question is this piece of legislation, this apparently very good piece of legislation, is Nancy Pelosi bringing this out, or is this being allowed to come forward by way of throwing a bone to the dogs of the progressive base in the Democratic Party, or is it a serious effort to stand up to George W. Bush? And I would submit to you that the answer to that question is going to be largely decided over the next 48 hours depending on how many of us call our members of the House of Representatives and say, please stand firm on FISA. Hold these guys accountable. And if you go to callcongress.org, which is, it just points you to a page on my website where I've got a list of all the 800 numbers that I've been able to find for Congress. And if you have any others that you know of, let me know, as well as the main number in the Capitol. Callcongress.org, there's the phone number right there, and you can call. So how much power should government have? Well, when it comes to wiretapping, it should be very limited, in my opinion. It should be under the oversight of a court. When it comes to individual choices, though, should the government be able to say to the family of a child who is so severely disabled that she's not able to understand what menstruation is, or communicate, who can't talk, literally can't talk, not because she's mute, but because she doesn't have the mental capacity to form words. She's, you know, cognitively very, very young, let's say, a baby for all practical purposes, in a teenager's body. Should the parents have the right to say, this kid's going to get a hysterectomy so that she's not going to have a lifetime of pain? This is what Allison Thorpe, Katie's mother, said. She said, first of all, this is not about me. If it was about me, I would have given up caring for Katie a long, long time ago. It's about quality of life, and for Katie to not have the associated problems of menstruation adds to her quality of life. It means she can continue with the quality of life we can give her now. Katie wouldn't understand menstruation at all. She has no comprehension about what will be going on in her body. All she would feel is the discomfort, the stomach cramps and the headaches, the mood swings, the tears, and wonder what is going on. On the other hand, some disabilities rights organizations are saying, hey, wait a minute. This is a slippery slope. You start down this path, where are we going to end up? Euthanasia? I think, frankly, everything is a slippery slope. There are, you know, there are very few absolute black and whites, and these are the points where we have to say, as a society, we're going to behave rationally. You know, the flip side of this is Phyllis Schlafly's thing of can a court order a kid to take Ritalin for ADHD? I don't think they should be allowed to. I think the court's power should be limited, frankly, in both cases. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Well, it's time for a Nixon alert here.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Right. Yeah. Strange stuff going on out there. Richard Nixon, this from ABC News, the blotter, just revealed today, Brian Ross and Avni Patel reporting. They went back and they found the tapes. Now, Fred Thompson makes a big deal about how he was the guy who, in the Senate, who revealed the existence, or actually he was a lawyer at the time, he was the guy who revealed the existence of the White House tapes. So they went back to the tapes, and they discovered Nixon and his aides, Nixon and Haldeman specifically, discussing Fred Thompson. Here's actually, it begins with a conversation with Alexander Haig, who was the chief of staff at the time. And he brings up Fred Thompson. He's Alexander Haig. He says, he's talking to Fred Thompson. And Nixon interjects. He says, oh, expletive deleted that ends that begins with an S. He's dumb as hell, Fred Thompson. Who is he? He won't say anything. And then Fred Buzhardt, the attorney for the White House, the White House counsel, he says, our approach is now we got a pretty good rapport with Fred Thompson. He came through fine for us this morning. And Nixon says, he isn't very smart, is he? Not extremely so, but Buzzard says, interrupted by the president. But he's friendly, Nixon says. Yeah, he's friendly, Buzzard echoes. Good, says Nixon. Later, Thompson agrees to secretly undercut the credibility of John Dean, the guy who was blowing the whistle on the White House. And Buzzard, talking to Nixon, he says, they finally got Dean under oath. Thompson will work with us. So, good. Yes, sir, he says. This is Buzzard. He is willing to work with us. He is also willing to work with us on shifting some focus to the Democrats. Yeah, that worked very well for them, didn't it? Turning Watergate into a Democratic scandal. In our other crazy news of the day, The Resistance. It's a Christian media watchdog group. They are all over the New York Post reporting. They're worked up over the ultra-femme anchors of Fox News. The group's leader, Mark Dice, rants in an email. He says, I see shorter skirts on the women of Fox News than I do on prostitutes being arrested on cop shows. Fox News responds, we're always flattered to have everyone talking about us. Yeah. I'm telling you, their new business channel is going to look like the Page Three girls in the British tabloids. It's just so anyway, here's another example of government intervention. This was in Canada, and actually the government backed down on this one. This was I suppose a victory, depending on how you look at it. The Child Protection Agency in Quebec is not going to compel Anil Lasprance, a three-year-old boy who has cancerous cells in his brain and spinal cord, to receive chemotherapy after his parents had said that they would prefer he had alternative medicine. And this actually went through a whole court proceeding, and they were going to force this kid to take chemotherapy. So at what point does government intervene, and at what point does the government listen in on us? And how do we do something about that? Liz in Valley Glen, California. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to your comments about the girl who had cerebral palsy.
Yeah.
When I was young and first moved to California, I was a social worker and had a client who had she was retarded, actually. And she had a child, and guess who was taking care of that child? Her parents.
Right.
I think with court oversight, if some parents wanted to do that, when they saw that the child was not capable. I mean, some people, from what I understand about retarded children, they used to die very young, and now with our medical advances, they live to be 30 and 40, and they still have brains of, you know, I guess it varies in age, lots from 6-year-olds to, you know, 10-year-olds or whatever, and or younger, actually. They don't have the appropriate skills to deal with another child.
Yeah. Well, this isn't about sterilizing her. This is about preventing her from experiencing the pain of menstruation. But the point is similar, Liz, and your point is well made. Thank you very much. Katie in Newport Beach, California. You want to correct me on something here?
Oh, not necessarily. My understanding of cerebral palsy was that it is mainly just a physical, not a mental disability. And that, you know, and I'm not sure about this girl in particular, but...
Well, apparently, there's more going on than just cerebral palsy. I'm not an expert on it either, but her mother is explicitly asserting that she does not have the ability to understand what menstruation is.
And I think you were talking about the slippery slope that you go on, and I think, you know, and not to condemn the mother or anything, but when you do kind of start to bring mental versus physical disabilities into it. And, there, you know, there was that similar case with Ashley, the Ashley treatment, and
yeah.
the pillow angel.
Yeah.
Understanding with her was that she was even, her mental capacity was that of like an 18-month-old baby.
And that's so right. And her parents were pushing their 50s, and they were saying by the time they hit their 60s, she would be too physically big for them to handle. Katie, I got to run,
yeah.
But thank you very much for the call. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our number, TomHartmann.com for our live chat room.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. This new FISA legislation, this is interesting. The House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers and the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Sylvester Reyes introduced what's called the RESTORE Act, which is an acronym for Responsible Electronic Surveillance That Is Overseen, Reviewed, and Effective, Act of 2007. Key provisions, this is a summary from the Center for American Progress. It restores court oversight of intelligence by requiring that electronic surveillance programs be approved by the FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, mandates that FISA warrants be obtained when the administration wants to undertake surveillance of persons in the U.S., provides no retroactive immunity for telecom companies that cooperated with the administration's warrantless surveillance, does not require individual warrants when targets are reasonably believed to be abroad. This is where you're tapping somebody in Germany who's talking to somebody in Spain. The call happens to be routed through the United States. Is, you know, there's really no reason for there to be a warrant in that case. And that is the one reasonable exception to the existing FISA law, by the way, in the opinion of many of us, in my opinion. And it ensures that FISA is the exclusive means of electronic surveillance, no modifications. So that seems like a good thing, definitely a good thing. Rebecca in Edmonton has some thoughts on this. Hey, Rebecca.
Good morning. It's Edmonds, Washington.
Yep.
If Bush would only obey those laws, that would be great. But what new powers is he being given? I haven't had time to study this.
As far as I can tell, I haven't read the entire bill. I've looked at it. We printed the thing out, I've read the writings of several people who have read it, who I respect,
right.
And it appears that he's not been given any new powers.
Okay, that's great. Okay, I just wanted to tell you, in addition, that we are fighting corporate power in Washington State through trying to get Dennis Kucinich enough delegates to do extremely well and perhaps win the nomination, we're hoping. And I just took on the biggest volunteer job of my life in agreeing to be a coordinator.
That's great, Rebecca.
The state coordinator. And we have launched our campaign, and we are really organizing. And we want people to know that we are up and running. And we go through the national website to reach each state now.
Right, which is Kucinich.us.
Yeah.
Rebecca, thank you very much for your activism and for getting out there and standing up and participating. David in Granby, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, David.
Yes, thank you. It's good to talk to you. You were talking earlier about Fred Thompson's relationship with the White House during the Watergate investigation.
Right.
And I had been reading from a number of sources that due to a deal that had been worked out among the senators, they were going to give Thompson the first crack at Alexander Butterfield to ask the question about the White House taping system. But Thompson actually, before the questioning came up, he informed the White House that that's what he was going to be doing. And that lead time that the White House had was what enabled them to go back and remove whatever it was on the 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the tapes.
Oh, interesting. So he provided the space for the, no pun intended, for the Rosemary Woods gap.
Yeah, so it's not just that he was friendly to the White House. He was actively, trying to undermine the investigation.
Well, and in fact, that's what the White House tapes indicate, is that he's on our side. He's one of our guys. He's going to turn this thing against the Democrats. And he's not too bright, by the way, as Nixon said. So it'll be interesting to see how Grandpa Fred does in the debates this afternoon. David, thanks for the heads up on that. I get off the air here at noon Pacific time, 3 o'clock Eastern time, 3 p.m. Eastern time. And Louise and I are going to go home and watch the debate and check it out. It'll be interesting, I think. I hope. Marie in Austin, Texas. Hey, Marie.
Hi. Listen, I wish the Democratic Party would do a lot more, of course, because right now in the New York Times today, October 9th, the Democrats are talking about supporting the, more wiretapping powers for the president, and he shouldn't have any of these powers.
No, this is the problem with the headline in today's New York Times, is that the headline in the first three or four paragraphs seem to indicate, or don't indicate, they say right out, the Democrats are getting ready to roll over. But in fact, that article was written before this legislation was introduced, and you look at the legislation, and the legislation looks pretty solid. And you know, John Conyers is putting this thing out, and it's not giving Bush what he wants. So the New York Times apparently yesterday, Eric Lichtblau and the other guy who was writing with him, Carl Hulse, apparently the information that I don't know about the backroom machinations here. You know, I mean, it may well be that the Rahm Emanuel wing, you know, the Republican light wing of the Democratic Party, was feeding them information to try and get people ready for a wimp out on the part of the Democrats. Or it could have been that the Republicans were feeding them information to try and get people ready for a wimp out on the part of the Democrats. Or it could have been that the progressives were feeding them information so that they would say that the Democrats are getting ready to wimp out, so that the American public would go to callcongress.org or, you know, the telephone number 202-225-3121, right, you know, or any of the toll-free numbers, and start raising hell. I don't know which of those scenarios, or it could be that Eric and Carl just got it wrong. But it looks, and you know,
well,
this may be subject to change.
Because this is like what we see on the surface and not what's happening underneath, and I get that. I used to be a precinct chair here in Austin, but it's like Bush shouldn't have this power. I pay for a service not to be wiretapped and listened in on, and I don't think Bush should have ever been given this power unless he could really show this. And right now, Nancy Pelosi's talking about torture, which I also feel is wrong because that really undermines who we are as a country. And my father did fight in World War II under Patton, and it's like we should be putting on the brakes and the kajbah on this Bush administration. Because
we defeated the Nazis. Right. We defeated the Nazis in Germany. We defeated the fascists in Spain and Italy. And we defeated Tojo and the Japanese Empire without torture.
Right.
We won World War II without undermining
our civil rights here at home.
Right. In fact, one of the things that actually helped our armies, particularly in Europe, was particularly toward the end of the war, was that the Germans were willing to surrender to us because they knew they wouldn't be tortured, and so they laid down their arms.
Right.
Our unwillingness to engage in torture and to become the enemy, like Bush has done, led to the saving, arguably, of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of American lives in combat. Marie, thank you very much for your very cogent points. Bill in Hampstead, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
This is Bill in New York. I'd like to return to the subject of forced medication or non-forced medication, whatever that we were discussing before.
Right. At what point does the government intervene in our lives?
I happen to have a son who was pressured by his school psychologist to take Ritalin, where his doctor indicated that Ritalin was not appropriate at the point, and was told by the school psychologist to fire the doctor and get another doctor. We chose not to do that, but there are all sorts of unqualified professionals out there prescribing medication for the children that they can go get a court order to have it put through.
Yeah, well, qualified or unqualified, licensed professionals. I'll tell you from, you know, I've written 7 books on attention deficit disorder, and I speak at a lot of these conferences, and I know a lot of the folks who are you know, in the industry, as it were. And there's a huge raging debate among professionals in the field, and which makes it even more difficult for parents, you know, to figure out what's going on and which way is up. And the bottom line is, when you have a child whose learning style is different from the teaching style of the school, and in my opinion, that's 90% or a large chunk of what's going on with this, with many of these ADHD diagnoses, you have a choice. We have a choice as a society. We can choose either to change the school. In other words, go to smaller classrooms, and that's what we did. We actually started a private school up in New Hampshire called the Hunter School after my Hunter in a Farmer's World concept of description of ADHD, where the classroom sizes can be as small as 4 kids. And, you know, are you going to go down to a smaller classroom, you know, 5 kids, 10 kids, 15, 20 kids, or are you going to go inside the brain of the child with a chemical and alter the way the child's brain works? And, you know, which is cheaper, and there's a $1 billion industry behind it, and you don't have to spend money on education and all those liberal things. And for the last 15 years or so, the conventional wisdom has been change the child, not the school. And increasingly, a lot of parents are saying, no, we'd rather change the schools than the kids. And then it gets into the problem of No Child Left Behind and funding and everything else. But your point is well taken, Bill, and I appreciate the call. Brian in Everett, Washington. Got about a minute before we got to take a break here. Brian, what's up?
Yeah, well, Tom, you're the only shrink I trust, seeing as how I got to where I can see you.
Okay.
But I tell you about drugs, and, you know, you can consider me someone who takes a psychotropic medication. I just think Walgreens is just where I get my stuff, you know? And it's like, when you talk about...
Well, I'm taking a psychotropic medication right now. I'm drinking green tea.
Well, I tell you what, there's a lot of green things. And I tell you what, when it comes to wiretapping and surveillance, you know, are they trying to prevent terrorist attacks? Or do they want to know if I'm going to meet this dude around the corner? What do they want to know?
I think they want to know both. And I think that there's a third element. And this is the one that really creeps me out. I think they want to know what the Democrats are doing in their strategy sessions. I call me paranoid, call me a conspiracy freak, whatever. I don't care.
I
absolutely believe that if these guys...
It's the eyeball.
There you go. There you go, Brian. You got it. If these guys were willing to hack into Teddy Kennedy's computer, and they did, and we know that they did, then in my opinion, they are also willing to listen into Teddy Kennedy's phone conversations. And I don't know why the Democrats are not out there screaming, "What are they listening to us? Prove to us that you're not listening to us." And put them on the spot. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, the new FISA bill seems to be the big topic of the day.
Well, the new FISA bill certainly is the new topic of the day, and it's interesting. The National Strategy for Homeland Security was unveiled today at the White House. They're talking about these various inside threats. And the press wanted to know, reasonably well, why it has taken 5 years to come up with this plan, or this actually is not a plan. It's a national strategy. And, of course, one of the things that they were pushing very hard today was the FISA reforms and how it's going to protect America.
Right. Oh,
what's also interesting is at the same time, as you know, we're covering the White House, we're also covering the United Nations. And this week, they are talking about disaster risk reduction, and they don't just mean things like bombs, et cetera, but also things like climate change. And the Homeland Security, this National Strategy for Homeland Security, also includes things such as weather, hurricanes, et cetera. Well, one of the interesting factoids in the United Nations is that these countries, including ourselves, spend less than 1% of their GDP on risk reduction activities, but they put all this money into defense and dealing with disasters like Katrina after it happens, but they're not doing what they really should in terms of risk reduction.
Yeah, we're all set to fight a war, but according to USA Today, I mean, I'm out here in Portland, Oregon, and we're hearing that we're going to have 60-mile-an-hour winds this afternoon. It's going to rain like hell, and I'm looking at USA Today, and it says that although it's not going to come on shore, that just off the Pacific Northwest coast is a low, you know, a depression, a low-pressure area equivalent to a Category 3 hurricane. And I mean, this is and we just had the earliest snowfall and the highest snowpack in the mountains just up above us, which is all the kind of stuff that is like, you know, hello, flood's knocking, and the city isn't ready for a flood.
Exactly. And that is really that the sort of climate shifting, as they call it, is really part of the focus. A couple other things at the White House today. Asked about Gordon Brown and the pulling out of the British troops. The White House is saying that General Petraeus has expressed confidence and does not have a problem with this, and therefore the president does not either.
Ellen, speaking of Petraeus, I have a question for you. I am hearing conflicting stories about the Bush administration wanting to attack Iran. One is that the only thing that's stopping them is Gates. That Gates has been working in back channels and effectively sabotaging the Bush administration's desire to start bombing Iran. The other is that I've heard Petraeus is taking both sides of this issue, but I don't know. I mean, do you have any special insight on
that? I'm not sure, but I had a conversation over the last 24 hours with somebody who is very connected with what the administration might do, and I said, well, what are chances that we are going to bomb Iran? And this particular person said to me, who I trust has a pretty good idea, listen, do you want to be Bush and leave office knowing that Iran has increased their nuclear capabilities and you did nothing about it? And is that how Bush wants to lead his legacy? And succinctly said, that is one of the best political reasons I have heard yet for why Bush may do what he may do.
But at the same time, I mean, if you were, let's reframe the question. If you were George Bush, would you want to leave office knowing that there are still 4.5 million Iraqi refugees who are unattended to and have no help? Would you want to leave office knowing that there's, you know, hundreds of thousands, I guess about 2 million refugees in Darfur, where you and I are going to be in a few months? Would you want to leave office?
Can I answer that question for you?
Sure.
You and I do not look like George Bush, and that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the thing. He's all about war.
But he thinks very differently than we think, and I think that's the important component here when it regards Iran.
So therefore, we should expect that he's probably going to drop bombs on Iran.
Well, I don't know if we can expect it, but as my source said, the chances have gone up.
Interesting. Okay, and you were going to make another point. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Well, the only other point was, let's see. The other issue was this on this the Bin Laden video, which was in the front page of the Washington Post today, about the fact that this company that obviously had been doing work for the CIA that found the video, sent it to the White House. The White House said that they're upset about it, and no, the leak did not come from them. Now, make of that what you want.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. So you and I are going to the Sudan in March. Any interest in going to the Burmese border?
Oh, yeah.
I was kicking this around with Louise this morning. I've been thinking about this for a while. I've been near that border where the Karen refugees are coming across, the indigenous people from Burma into Thailand. And you go up to Chiang Mai and, you know, off.
Great
off
shopping
the,
there, but also
northeast.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and we should talk about this off air, I suppose.
Very interesting. I will email you later.
Yeah, I want to highlight this issue of Burma.
I am in New York today, although, as you know, we have people both here and whatever. And the issue of Burma did come up at the United Nations Security Council briefing. And one of the questions that the United States ambassador to UN was asked is, why is it so long? Why are we taking so long to negotiate some kind of deal here? Why is this happening?
Yeah, and
he did not have
question.
A good answer.
There was not a good answer. Yeah, okay.
But he did say, well, Mrs. Bush spoke with the Secretary General this morning, and I think that Mrs. Bush really should be commended because she has. I don't know why she chose Burma, but she's taken a very keen interest in it.
Yeah, George's wife, Laura Bush.
That's right.
That's the Mrs. Bush you're talking about. Yeah, she's
Mrs. Bush
and
too.
And yeah, and at the same time, there's stories in the National Enquirer, which oddly enough, actually usually is pretty accurate about these things, that that couple is now estranged. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. Thoughts? No?
I have no idea. Very difficult
okay.
to tell.
All righty. Ellen Radner, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen. Good talking to you. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio. defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. When are we going to finally return to rational trade policies, or for that matter, rational labor policies, or for that matter, rational political policies in general? You're going to be treated this afternoon, no doubt, to a parade of irrationality as the Republicans have their debate. Is it going to be another one of these things where, I see your 4 Guantanamos and I'll raise you to 6 Guantanamos. I see your torturing with waterboarding and I raise you to torturing with sledgehammers. I'll raise your thumbscrews. What's it going to be? And, of course, is Grandpa Fred going to fall asleep? I don't know. We could... I'll bet. That's a bad pun. In all probability, I think it's Intrade.com, you know, the Irish betting site. I'll bet that they're taking odds on whether or not Fred Thompson will fall asleep during the debate tonight. Anyway, David Sirota is with us. David Sirota is a nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist for Creators Syndicate. He's also a New York Times bestselling author. His last book, Hostile Takeover. His new book coming out this coming spring is called The Uprising, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. His website, David Sirota, SIROTA.com. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's always great having you on. You have written a couple of brilliant pieces recently for Creator Syndicate, the Tyranny of the Tiny Minority. I actually shared some of the numbers on the air when you published it and credited you for them. But if you want to give us the snapshot of that, I think it bears repeating.
Right. Well, a lot of people are frustrated with the Congress's inability to pass anything, and if you actually particularly the Senate, correct. And if you take a look at there's all these issues that have 85% public support, but the Senate hasn't been able to pass legislation that respects that public opinion. Because if you actually take a look at the senators who are blocking that legislation, they only represent a very, very small minority of the country. We're not talking, they got 45, 46, 47 senators. That's 47% of the Senate. But when you actually look at the states that those senators come from, and then you boil it down even further to the number of votes that those senators need to get elected, it's an extremely small percentage of the country.
My recollection is it was like 11% of the U.S. population is capable of holding the Senate hostage.
That's exactly right. 11% of the voting age population in this country has the Senate representation to stop any bill. And so what I concluded was that if you understand that math, then you understand that the way to do things on many of these issues is to stop things, specifically on the Iraq War. The way to start changing direction in the Iraq War is to stop the funding for the war, rather than keep trying to pass things when, 11, 12, 13% of the country has the Senate representation to stop that.
Right. So the Democrats should be adopting a negative strategy, as the Republicans have for years, rather than a proactive strategy, rather than a positive one, rather than trying to pass all these wonderful pieces of legislation. They should just be blocking nasty stuff. But, the fact of the matter is there's not that much nasty stuff to block other than the war, is there?
Well, I think there's a number of these trade deals that are moving through.
Yeah,
through
and I want to get to that in just a second. In the same context, though, of the 11% of the U.S. population having enough Senate, having 40 plus senators so that they can block anything from getting through the Senate by filibuster, isn't there something similar to that going on in Iowa right now, where you have 6% of registered Iowans actually participate in the caucuses? Mm-hmm. And only about half of Iowans who are eligible to vote are registered. So you've got 3% of the population of one state making the decision, at least with regard to the Democratic primary, that in all probability will choose who's going to be the president of the United States.
Yeah, I would agree. There's some very legitimate concerns about that. I think that the problem is that if you go the other way and you say, okay, everyone should have everybody should vote, or the primary should be all at the same time for all the states, is then you sort of weigh the primary for big money, because it's
right.
The more states you have, the more it costs to actually advertise in those states. I mean, I think the way around this, or the fairest way to do this, is to consider rotating the states every couple of years. I mean, the idea, and I love Iowa and I love New Hampshire, but the idea that these states, the same states, keep selecting the nominees, it just seems a little bit, it doesn't seem all that representative.
Yeah, it's an anachronism in some ways. But what about just going back to the system that preceded this, which is where the party gets together and the party makes the decision, and if you, David Sirota, and me, if I want to have a say in the Democratic Party and the choice of the nominee, then I go out and I volunteer with my local party and become a precinct chairman or captain or whatever, you know, work my way up in the local party so that I get to be one of the guys, one of the men and women who goes to whatever, wherever the meeting is held, the annual meeting, where the nominee is picked and actually
within
the party.
A very, very, very interesting, idea. I had in reporting for my next book, I talked to somebody who had worked on the effort, the reform effort, to open up the parties, to basically direct election primaries or direct election caucuses. And what he said to me was, you know, in some ways the reformers, you know, went too far. We got something that we didn't really want. We tried to clean out the bosses and we threw the baby out with the bathwater. So I agree. I think what you're saying is you're cutting to the issue of the fact that the direct election primaries as they stand right now just allow people to, you know, candidates to go in and with the most money possible and try to win the election with just television ads. And it cuts out people who work really hard for the party who may not be millionaires or billionaires. I think there's very legitimate, you've raised a very legitimate idea, and I think it's something the party should really consider.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking about this for a long, long time, and it just, if the main, my main call to action, you know, almost on, regardless of the issue, my main call to action is for people to get politically involved. It's not enough just to vote. You, and somebody calls up and they complain about the Democrats, they complain about Nancy Pelosi. My first question to them is, when was the last time you went to a Democratic Party meeting?
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's right. And remember, and you should, you know, remember, you know, even though the convention is sort of a showpiece, you know, we have the worst of both worlds in the primary. Now we got these direct election primaries where the candidates can basically buy them with big money. But right now, I think that last count, 40% of the delegates in the Democratic Party are superdelegates. These are the elected officials and basically party bigwigs who by virtue of their offices or by how much money they give, they have 40% of the delegates. So only 60% of the delegates are actually elected with elections.
So if we did two really simple things, if we just leveled that field, number one, and number two, if we brought public financing of elections in to get the money out so that even the delegates couldn't be bought, which used to be the old problem, then we could really substantially clean up politics both at the primary and the regular election level.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, the problem is obviously that the people who are in the party right now, the people who have the power, don't have any interest in doing that.
Right, and that's why, again, my call to, you know, people say, oh, you support the Democratic Party. No, I'm calling for something far more radical than that. I don't, you know, I'm not here to support the Democratic Party. I'm here to suggest that we should infiltrate it and take it over.
I absolutely agree, and to be honest, that will be the best thing possible politically in the long term for the party. Not just the best thing for the country substantively, but politically for the party in winning elections for the long term, that will be the best thing for it.
Absolutely. You look at progressives, you know, where that has happened. Brian Schweitzer, Bernie Sanders. Well, Bernie's not a Democrat, so he's not probably a good example.
Right.
But Brian Schweitzer in Montana is a great example. I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, as progressive as Bernie Sanders,
mm-hmm.
winning in a red state. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's just incredible. Your old boss, Bernie Sanders, as I recall.
That's right.
David, we just have a minute or so left. I wanted to talk to you about free trade also. There's the Financial Times today. The grab for a job, Democrats turn protectionist and adrift to the left. Even Republicans are now starting to talk about our trade policies having failed. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think that this Peru deal is coming through the Congress right now. It's an extension of NAFTA down to Peru. It looks like it's going to pass, and my take is that's a pretty tragic considering the Democrats ran against these kinds of deals. But the silver lining is, if the deal is that Peru passes and the other three, South Korea, Panama, and Colombia, those deals we get some real opposition to, if that ends up being what happens, I would say that that's a major step forward. That's a win on the, a net win for us. I think there's a legitimate hope that happens.
Yeah, Costa Rica just voted to join CAFTA, but apparently it's a result of just massive spending and lobbying by both the U.S. government, the Costa Rican government, and all these multinational corporations.
Huge. We had our ambassador running around making threats of economic retribution if the people of Costa Rica voted against it.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders went down there to try and set him straight. But, you know, one guy, I mean, against a huge machine. David Sirota, absolutely one of the most brilliant writers out there writing. I guess that's what writers do. on the modern political scene. Creators.com, DavidSirota.com. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Great talking with you. And check out his new book, The Uprising. It'll be out in stores in the spring. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, it looks like the Supreme Court's at it again. This is what you get when you elect a right-wing maniac. Well, actually, we didn't elect him as president. This is what you get when the Supreme Court appoints a right-wing maniac as president, and then 4 years later, the governor of the state of Ohio participates in a criminal conspiracy to get him so-called reelected. What am I ranting about? Khalid El-Masri, 44-year-old guy. He was in Europe, you know, just walking around, minding his own business. CIA snatches him off the streets, ships him to Afghanistan, where for 4 months he's tortured. And then they discover, oops, this guy's not a terrorist. He's got nothing to do with any of these people. He simply happens to be Muslim. So he sues the Bush administration, says, hey, you owe me something. The Supreme Court today terminated the lawsuit, effectively endorsing Bush administration arguments that state secrets would be revealed if the case were allowed to proceed. The Supreme Court of the United States has decided that torture ain't that big a deal, apparently. Hillary Clinton gave an absolutely brilliant speech on this topic some time back, and it's worth listening to again. And you know, regardless of what you think of Hillary Clinton, just catch this.
When General Washington led his soldiers across the Delaware River and onto victory in the Battle of Trenton, he captured nearly 1,000 foreign mercenaries, and he faced a crucial choice. How would General Washington treat these prisoners? The British had already committed atrocities against Americans, including torture. As David Hackett Fisher describes in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Washington's Crossing, thousands of American prisoners of war were treated with extreme cruelty by British captors. There are accounts of injured soldiers who surrendered being murdered instead of quartered. Countless Americans dying in prison hulks in New York Harbor. Starvation and other acts of inhumanity perpetrated against Americans confined to churches in New York City.
And it was true. The British were absolutely brutal against the American soldiers, against the American insurgents, because they called us an insurgency, an illegal insurgency. So what did George Washington do when confronted with, what shall I do with these 1,000 soldiers that I've got, these prisoners?
Well, you can imagine, the light of our ideals shone dimly in those early dark days, years from an end to the conflict, years before our improbable triumph and the birth of our democracy. General Washington announced a decision unique in human history, sending the following order for handling prisoners. Treat them with humanity, and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren. George Washington understood that how you treat enemy combatants can reverberate around the world, We must convict and punish the guilty in a way that reinforces their guilt before the world and does not undermine our values.
Or our moral authority. This is, you know, yesterday we were talking, it was Columbus Day, and I mentioned wetiko, this word that Professor Jack Forbes, a Native American and professor of Native American studies at UC Davis, shared with me back 12, 15 years ago when I was first writing the first draft of Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. This idea of a culture that cannibalizes other cultures. And he made the point to me that Native Americans, when they were confronted by European invaders, many of the tribes, particularly the more peaceful tribes, the ones who very low population density, like the Shoshone. I mean, basically they didn't have instruments of war. They just ran. And he said, they were confronted with just a couple of choices. Number one, you stand there and die. Number two, you run, you flee. Or number three, you engage the enemy using the enemy's tactics. And the danger of that is that you become your enemy. And I would submit to you that to some extent, to some small but tragic extent, at the highest levels of our government, is what has happened, is that we are becoming, morally anyway, we are becoming those that we would condemn, those who we are concerned are out to harm us. And we have to reverse that. We absolutely have to reverse that. America needs to reclaim, we need to reclaim our values as Americans and say, this is where we stand. This is the ground on which we stand. This is a nation of laws. We don't wiretap people illegally without a court order. We don't torture people, period, under any circumstances. We are a nation, we are proud to be Americans. Don't you long for the ability to say that again? 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our phone number.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This case, the Supreme Court just trashed. This is the case. They're saying, oh, the state secrets will be revealed. First of all, just a little history. In 1953, when Dwight Eisenhower was president, was the first time that the federal government asserted that it was actually the Pentagon asserted the state secrets defense. It was a bomber, a military plane crashed. Three widows sued the government for information about how their husbands died, and the Pentagon said, sorry, that would be state secrets, and the Supreme Court accepted that. And that was the beginning of the doctrine of the courts being impotent in the face of state secrets. It has been used rarely in the years since then. In fact, OpenTheGovernment.org says it was only used six times from that original Supreme Court case up until the Carter administration, for all practical purposes. 39 times it's been used since Bush became president. Now, this is the guy who the Germans have issued now 13 arrest warrants against CIA agents for snatching this guy, Al-Masri. the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, has said, you know, yeah, this guy is a German and he was not a terrorist and he shouldn't have been taken off and tortured. It's like the whole world knows about it, but and he was suing for $75,000. That's what he wanted. The Supreme Court says no, you can't have that. But even at the height of the Cold War, even when we had 10,000 nuclear missiles pointed at us, our leaders understood that the moral position of our country was critical. This is Dwight Eisenhower. I just want to share this with you very quickly, and then we'll take your calls. It's less than a minute. Dwight Eisenhower speaking at the Republican National Convention in 1964. Dwight Eisenhower.
There is only one real peace now, and that is peace for all time.
Okay, and how do we achieve that peace, Mr. President?
Today, we are competing for men's hearts and minds and trust all over the world. In such a competition, what we are at home and what we do at home is even more important than what we say abroad. Here again, my friends, we find constructive work for each of us. What each of us does, how each of us acts, has an influence on this question.
And how we as a nation act, President Eisenhower says.
There can be no enduring peace for any nation while other nations suffer privation, oppression, and a sense of injustice and despair. In our modern world, it is madness to suppose that there could be an island of tranquility and prosperity in the sea of wretchedness and frustration.
Amen. And so here's Dwight Eisenhower basically saying, feed the hungry if you want to stop war. Bernice in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Bernice, welcome to the program.
Hi. Sorry, this doesn't really have directly to do with what he's saying, but I just wanted to say that this weekend I was watching some old tapes that I have because I tape everything from TV. and this was the premiere episode of Donahue's show on MSNBC, which, of course, they took him off quickly. This was Scott Richter that was on the show. And also it was Senator Inhofe from Alaska. And Ahmed Chalabi.
Inhofe is from Oklahoma, I believe, but yeah.
Oh, that's right, that's right. Yes, I got him mixed up with the other crazy. They were talking about, you know, the nuclear problem and how Saddam was going to come in and take over our country. And, I mean, they were just going on. And this was the run-up to Iraq. But it was sounding exactly like what is going on now with General Petraeus and, you know, the Washington Post, I think it was this morning. You know, all these articles and interviews, there were some this weekend also, leading up to Iran. And it's sounding exactly the same.
I know. I agree. And it's a scary thing that, or scary is the wrong word. It's disheartening that we may be repeating history. And at the same time, it's also encouraging to hear that there's even blowback within the administration, that Secretary of Defense Gates now is one of the major voices speaking out against the Cheney faction in the White House that wants to bomb Iran. By the way, 15 seconds. This is a 15-second commercial that Dwight Eisenhower ran when he ran for president.
He has met Europe, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. Yeah. And he did maintain the peace, and he ended the Korean War. Alan in Bloomfield, New Jersey. Hey, Alan.
Hi, how are you, Tom? Nice day to talk to you. I want to digress a little to your conversation with David Sirota, and I've heard you talk about it before, about people getting involved in their local area groups. I belong to Blue Wave NJ, and the end of that is .com. And I think that if there's a place on your website that we can post ours, as well as we're located in Essex County, New Jersey. And I know that there are groups all over the country that are similar to ours with 400, 500, 600 people that are members of the group. And we're very active out here. We hold forums. Our whole goal is to educate and bring the information, as you do, to the fore for everybody in our area.
That's a great idea. You know, I've registered this URL. I was surprised it was even available just a week or so ago, called callcongress.org. And it just points to a page on my website where I list the phone numbers for Congress. It doesn't deliver an ad or make me any money or anything like that. It's just, you know, just trying to give that information to people.
Exactly.
And I could add to that page links to groups like yours, fairly effortlessly. Why don't you drop me an email? My email, my contact information is on our website. And
you were talking about the numbers of the people that the 46 or 7 senators control. And in each of those red states that elected those people, the margin of victory for those people was not very great. And if know that there are people in their areas who are like thinkers, clearly we're going to be able to do something to motivate and get each area. And God willing, we'll all get the majorities that we need so that filibusters are not available to stop the legislation that we need to put through.
Well, and good point, Alan. Thank you very much. And yeah, be sure and drop me a note with the bluewavenj.org, and I'll get it on the website. And anybody else who is part of a local Democratic group or a local group, frankly, I'm a big supporter of the Green Party, and for that matter, the Republican Party. If you want to take it back, it's there. You know, turn the stars right back upside up, right side up again. It's pretty straightforward. But also, speaking of David Sirota and his comment about how 11% of the population can hold the country hostage, this is an argument actually for the nuclear option, which is blowing up the filibuster. I'm increasingly thinking that we probably should get rid of the filibuster because a small group of senators representing only 11% of the U.S. population is capable of blocking all legislation with 40 votes. So, anyhow, that's my thoughts on that. Kathy in Ohio. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the erosion of our Constitution and our values and our attitudes as a nation. This administration is just a party of bullies. They impose their so-called national security agenda. They have secret and not-so-secret torture tactics. The right-wing radio bullies and attacks on a daily basis. And we're even seeing our children. They're bullying, too. I mean, there was an incident in the news today where 4 children attacked an autistic boy. What are we becoming?
It's like the national zeitgeist.
Yes, we've set this attitude now in the past 8 years of just being horrible to other people. And if our government is the example, what's going to happen to us?
Well, this is both the good news and the bad news, Kathy. I mean, there's the old saying, I think it was Ben Franklin that's attributed to the a fish rots in the head down. And you know, to some extent, the national spirit, the national zeitgeist has become more coarse and more violent as a result of a coarse and violent man, George Bush, being appointed president in 2000. But at the same time, this is activating so many people. There are so many of us all across the country now who have been awakened by the abuses of this administration and the Republican Party in general, and the weak-kneed folks in the Democratic Party, that I see this as an absolutely pivotal moment in history. I think it's a great time for us to be alive. It's a great time for us to be active. It's an important time for us to be engaged and to be speaking out. Kathy, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks.
Yeah, there you go. We need to take on the bullies, for sure. And we need to say, I'm not afraid. I am not afraid. I'm not afraid of the terrorists. I'm not afraid of the Republican. I am not going to be cowed by them. We are going to stand up. We're Americans. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
celebrities all come to see us. Grateful they don't have to be us. Politicians play their best face card. Where is Bubba? Where's our leader? Where's our favorite lip reader? AWOL from the Texas National Guard. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation. This is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis.
When the Financial Times of London, without fear and without favor, their slogan, the Wall Street Journal of the United Kingdom, a very, very conservative newspaper, the Financial Times, representing the interests and goals of great wealth in the UK, the investor class, as the Wall Street Journal refers to it. This is their lead editorial in today's newspaper, right up at the top of the page. Their lead official editorial speaking in the voice of the Times, not an op-ed written by some person, but this is the Financial Times itself. The headline, "It is time to speak truth to U.S. power." The subhead, "The Supreme Court needs to rein in Bush's terror tactics." Bush's terror tactics. And what they are talking about is, is this case that I just, I told you about, tragically. They say as soon as today, the court could announce whether it will hear a case involving the renditions of terrorism suspects in secret prisons overseas. They go through all the time and time again, Mr. Bush has twisted the law to serve his own national security goals. He has given the rule of law a bad name and devalued the U.S. Constitution, all in the name of protecting the American people. The genius, and this is how they wrap this thing up. They say, the Supreme Court, it's in your hands now. You guys, since obviously the legislative branch is not stopping this guy, now it's up to you. And this is the last paragraph. The genius of American democracy is that it gives each branch of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, the power to check abuses by every other branch. Mr. Bush has abused his power, and Congress has failed to hold him to account. It is time the Supreme Court did so. Well, we appreciate the sentiment. We here in America, to those of you at the Financial Times, should any of you be listening, we appreciate the sentiment. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court chose not to rise to the occasion. Maurice in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Maurice, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Fine. But I'll get better. What's up?
Well, you mentioned, you played a clip by Eisenhower, and you opined that ultimately he said that, in order to stave off war, you should feed the hungry. Well, I'm quite sure you understand this, as Smedley Butler did. These people want war. They love war. And so, it sort of contradicts everything that you said, but I'm quite sure you realize this.
No, I understand that, and war is a very, very profitable thing, and it's a major industry now, and Eisenhower's warnings about the military-industrial governmental complex have come true. They absolutely have come true, and Maurice, you're spot on. And again, why we should have, A Department of Peace, and B, we should have these kinds of issues being discussed on a regular basis all the time. I mean, it's just the bottom line. Lynn in Westland, Oregon. Hey, Lynn. Listening on KPOJ, Lynn? No, Lynn.
Hi, Tom.
Okay. Whoop, I'm sorry. I had already pushed the button. Larry in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Larry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just fine. What's up?
Hey, I've been watching an internet site. It's called rockthedebates.org, and it's a group of people in Iowa that are filming the presidential candidates and asking them, what they feel about rectifying our problems with the Commission on Presidential Debates. I'm just wondering if you've seen that yet.
I have not, but thanks for the heads up. I'll go looking for it. Paula in Clifton, New Jersey. Hey, Paula.
Paul, what is?
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Tom, I think you have a great show, particularly since I can't hear Mike Malloy anymore. But I disagree with you about this torture. You there?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I think the American military has been torturing prisoners and Gore Vidal, I read something by him about in Second World War, the Marines in the South Pacific, the atrocities they carried out on Japanese prisoners make Guantanamo look like Boy Scouts.
Yeah. No, there were
atrocities.
It may not
have been the official policy.
Yeah, that's my point, Paul. There were certainly in time of war there are atrocities. I mean, war is legalized organized mass murder.
Right.
But the official policy of the United States has never in our history never been to torture until now. And that's the disaster. That is the absolute moral, spiritual, political fill in the blank disaster for this nation is that the Republican Party and George W. Bush have made torture our official policy. It's just a tragedy. Greta in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Greta.
I wish to comment on Americans' unawareness of what it means to have people, spy on them and have no accountability. What it means is they can make up any story they please, and you don't know what the story is, or something, they can tell it to the court, and they can send your neighbor, who you would never let in your apartment because you think he's an alcoholic or a drug addict, and they can send that neighbor in your apartment, and he can steal your knives and your bras and your, go mix up your, you know,
yeah,
your...
It's all very, very strange, Greta. There's a marvelous movie called The Lives of Others, that talks about what it was like in East Germany during the time that East Germany was communist East Germany. And I was in East Berlin when it was East Berlin, and I was in East Germany when it was East Germany. And, in fact, I had apparently an all-day encounter with a Stasi agent. I only realized it after watching the movie that this guy who had befriended me when I went to East Berlin was actually, and was constantly asking me a million questions. Was obviously working for the Stasi. But anyhow, you want to see the direction that we've been going. I think that we're about to stop, frankly, but you want to see that direction. Go see this. It's an absolutely brilliant movie called The Lives of Others. Coming up tomorrow, Thomas Bowden and I are going to be taking opposite sides of the issue of workers' rights. And Michael Gilbert is here asking, have men become disposable? Hey? That and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.